On the program today, the week that was, of course, since it's a Friday, big tobacco as a buying opportunity and not a good day for the internet. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday is where we are. The 21st of October is when we are. It is good to have you along, everybody. End of the week, 5 minutes of live radio, the entire global economy to talk about. It's a little thing we like to call the weekly wrap. For that, we've got Felix Salmon from Reuters, Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. They are both sitting in our tiny little studios in New York City. Hey, everybody.
They're comfy.
I like to say cozy.
Well, you're in the small one there. I can see you on the TV.
For New York, it's spacious. Let's face it.
That's right. I don't want to know what we're paying per square foot. So let's talk global here for a second. Felix, we'll start with you. China and its GDP came out this week, 6.7%, if you believe it, but it's what everybody expected. Across the pond, there's Brexit weighing upon the pound. We had inflation here this week in line with expectations. Where stand we global economy-wise?
I think everyone is doing just fine, except for Britain, which has basically voted to fall off into the North Sea and become an irrelevant island off the coast of Europe. So Britain is dreadful. I don't think that there's much in the way of Brexit repercussion globally, though.
All right. Lee, you're happy with how things stand here, domestic?
Yeah, I am. I mean, I agree with Felix that the UK is a problem, but I think that the falling currency is actually going to soften the blow a little bit. It's a great time to go to London.
Mm-hmm.
Here, look, I think we're muddling along. I think there's no cause for huge concern. I think there's a lot of uncertainty around the election. I think in corporate America, there's other issues. There's tremendous disruption happening everywhere you turn. Mm-hmm. That's unrelated to the economy. But
Lee, there's no uncertainty about the election. I mean, there is literally no uncertainty about the election.
Lee, go ahead.
But the same thing that's fueling the unrest in this country is fueling what happened in Brexit. I think there is this sense of global disenfranchisement. I mean, I think there is this feeling
and general discontent.
Even after the
right?
election, it doesn't go away after the election. It doesn't.
Right. Felix, do you disagree with that?
No, I agree that there is an uprising, in not just in Britain and the U.S., but in many countries, and that politicians are getting something of a wake-up call. I just don't think that anyone is really worried about what's going to happen on November the 8th.
No, but let's take it to November the 9th, right, and talk about what happens, not in the Dow or stocks or any of that jazz, but the economic future of this country as we move past this really divisive election. And what companies make of that, Felix?
What companies are going to have on November the 9th is another 4 years of continuity, which is the absolute best that they can hope for. And if anyone tells you that they can see out further than 4 years, they're, you know, trying to sell you a bridge. Just like no one can do this. This is the most stable 12-year period of, you know, that we could have hoped for. And I think that, you know, it's easy to worry about like long-term demographic trends and the like, but I think now is not actually the right time to do that worrying.
Is there no, Lee, discontent from having to bring back into the fold, economically speaking, people who might not have voted for the winner?
I think there's some of that. I think the continued unrest is probably going to be more felt on the social side. And I think the rebuilding of the Republican Party, however it begins to do that, I think is a long-term problem and issue. I think the kind of anti-free trade message is something that we're going to have to grapple with.
We were hoping that TPP would go through. TPP isn't going to go through, so there's that.
Yeah. All right, let's change gears here. We'll get to the corporate sort of reportage of the day. This proposed or rumored deal between AT&T to buy Time Warner, that is a big deal in the content and pipeline space. Lee?
It is. It sort of takes us back. I mean, that was, remember, AOL Time Warner? That was all about content meets carriage. But it's a different world now, and everything is converging. I mean, look at, you know, Verizon and AOL and Yahoo. I mean, AT&T already, you know, made this play for video with DirecTV, and now it's trying to bring everything together.
And Comcast has already bought NBC.
Mm-hmm. Right.
and they just threw another $200 million into BuzzFeed. So, yeah, the content and the pipes are coming back together again.
Well, so, all right. So sort of along those lines, just on content and how it gets out there. And we've got a piece from Kimberly Adams coming up after the break here in a minute. But this denial of service attack that's been happening on the East Coast today, shutting down a whole bunch of these companies, Felix, is there a concern about our fragility, I guess?
The internet is surprisingly robust,
I haven't been able to get to Twitter all day, yo. Come on.
I don't know. I learned about it on Facebook, which was kind of meta.
Oh, that is too funny. But Felix, you're not concerned?
No, I am concerned. I feel like there's a huge amount of complexity in the information infrastructure of the globe, and wherever you have complexity, you can have catastrophic failure. And what we're seeing now, I think, is really just a taste of what is possible, either just by mistake or thanks to a malign actor. Either way, things can go horribly wrong, and we've been pretty lucky up until now, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. All right, we got to go. That's Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine, Felix Salmon from Reuters. They both flew in from the West Coast in time to be on
Fusion,
our broadcast
darling.
Today. Thanks. Oh, I'm sorry, Fusion, darling. You know, I almost did it like two times ago. Anyway, got to go. Bye. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, we'll see you. Wall Street did it. Wall Street today was kind of the little engine that could. Started slow, worked its way back to break even. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. So, as Felix and Lee and I were talking about, not a good day for the internet economy. What is called a distributed denial of service attack has effectively shut down a big chunk of the internet today. Twitter, Spotify, Airbnb, Etsy, even the New York Times, all of them have had on and off service since early this morning. This morning's attacks did hit those sites. Denial of service attacks typically overwhelm sites by flooding them with traffic, by the way. That's why they're called denial of service. But it did not target those sites in particular. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams explains what's going on here.
Today's problems all stem from a little something called DNS. That stands for Domain Name Servers. That's the service that translates the words we type in for websites, like marketplace.org, into the IP address that actually directs you to the site. Joseph Lorenzo Hall is with the Center for Democracy and Technology.
Unfortunately, a lot of the services we create today sort of assume that the DNS is not going to be a problem. It will be quick and things will just work. And I think we need to rethink that.
The hackers in today's attack went after a company named Dyn, which handles DNS for a lot of other companies. Shane Tews is a cybersecurity expert with the American Enterprise Institute.
But what they've done is they've jammed up all the traffic from that one company. So it's like when you went to look for something, you basically got the internet version of a busy dial tone.
And thousands, if not millions, of previously compromised connected devices were all calling at once. But why primarily on the East Coast? Anne Baron DiCamillo is with Strategic Cyber Ventures. She says a lot of the system relies on old-fashioned wires to get data from place to place. And in the case of Dyn, those wires all led to one key point in New Hampshire.
The data center that houses their DNS servers are located geographically in this area. And because of how DNS traffic is routed, the primary impacted region was the East Coast region.
Dyn says its engineers are investigating the attack, as is the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Today's big merger news comes with lots of zeros, as merger news typically does, but it also comes with a couple of question marks. BAT, that's British American Tobacco, is offering $47 billion American dollars for the roughly 58% stake of Reynolds American it doesn't already own. That would bring together brands like Dunhill and Kent and Lucky Strike on the BAT side, with American mainstays Newport and Camel from Reynolds. The deal, should it happen, is a sign that this, that would be smoking, is a lucrative and attractive business in which to be. So here comes the question mark. Really? From the Marketplace Bureau at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Mitchell Hartman has that one.
This is the kind of ad you'll never hear on American TV again.
The first cigarette of the day. Man, how good that tastes.
Heavy restrictions on tobacco advertising in the U.S. have helped drive cigarette consumption down year after year for decades. And yet, you won't see graphic warning labels on cigarette packs, like in Europe and other developed regions, with graphic pictures of rotting teeth, a tracheotomy, gangrene. Regulations like that are blocked in the U.S. by the First Amendment. The upshot, says equity analyst Steve Marascia at Capital Securities, at this point, the U.S. is a very reliable market for tobacco companies.
You're getting a stable operating marketplace for them to conduct sales and try to grow their business and move their prices around to capture profitability.
This merger would leave just two giant tobacco companies in the U.S., giving them a lot of power to raise prices. Here's Joseph Agnese at analysis firm CFRA.
U.S. tobacco companies generate a significant amount of cash flow, which helps support 10% earnings growth per year for these companies.
But it's a declining market in the long run, and raising prices on cigarettes would likely drive consumption down more. Ken Warner, a professor of public health at the University of Michigan, thinks at this point tobacco companies are angling for short-term profit.
Exploit the existing market of addicted adult smokers as much as you can.
And Warner says that means tobacco companies will probably give up on attracting a lot of future smokers. Kids won't buy cigarettes that cost too much. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
It's been just about 2 weeks since Hurricane Matthew scraped up the east coast of the United States. A lot of the news of that storm got swept aside by the campaign spin of that weekend, if you remember the tape and the talk from the GOP nominee. But the after effects of the storm are still being felt on the ground in North Carolina, because in small towns, when a grocery store or a restaurant closes down, even for a couple of weeks, locals really feel it. From WUNC, Jay Price has the story from the eastern North Carolina town of Grifton.
I'm standing with Kelly Thomas, looking down a flooded street at the brown water flowing around her fast food restaurant. It's inside, too.
We're thinking right now about 2 feet.
She's come here two or three times a day for nearly a week just to look and think.
I know some people think that it's devastating, but for me to be able to process it, I kind of have to see it and see the progress of where it's at so my mind can process, hey, this is what's happening.
Grifton is my hometown. It's about what you'd expect from a place of 2,700 people. A small main street, a handful of shops and restaurants that aren't making anyone rich, a few churches. It's built along the Contentnea Creek, which also flooded after Hurricane Floyd in 1999, destroying dozens and dozens of homes and almost filling the restaurant Thomas now owns.
63 inches inside.
This flood has damaged perhaps 20 to 30 homes, says the man who's trying to hold things together, interim town manager Mark Warren. He's worried that some residents of damaged homes might not return. And there's another problem.
You know, the only grocery store we got is underwater.
Warren isn't sure when or even if it will reopen. It's a Piggly Wiggly store, not much bigger than a house. Pretty basic. But it's a crucial part of the town, and residents like Cassandra Roach have been glad to have it. She was shaken to hear that it might not come back.
What? I go to that Piggly Wiggly 5 or 6. I'm in there almost every day, so if it doesn't open, wow.
Flooding in North Carolina usually hits low-income people hardest. They're more likely to live in low-lying neighborhoods and less likely to have a car to drive somewhere distant to shop. Grifton has no public transportation, no taxi service, but it has neighbors like the town of Aden, 7 miles to the north. Aden has sent police officers, firefighters, and utility crews. Grifton and Aden have had to team up for so long, it's automatic. They even share a high school. Two churches set up tables at Aden Elementary School, feeding people from both towns.
Sweetheart, are you hungry? Would you like something to eat? Okay, I need a regular plate for somebody here, please.
Steve Tripp, the mayor of Aden, watches as people line up for spaghetti, boiled cabbage, and fragrant chicken and rice. He says a lot of outside attention has been on flooding in Greenville to the north and Kinston to the south. Cities with a lot more resources to handle a disaster. But Aden and Grifton have something else, volunteers in the community who help.
Because this is family. This people we see every day. This people we live with every day. It's people we know, the families. We know the people's name. We know the children. We know where they are in life.
He says if people in Grifton have to do without their Piggly Wiggly, neighbors or church volunteers will surely drive them to Aiden's. And with luck, they may only have to do that a couple of months. Warren, the Grifton manager, says Piggly Wiggly officials just told him they're assessing the damage, but they hope to eventually reopen. In Grifton, North Carolina, I'm Jay Price for Marketplace.
Coming up,
it extracts punishment before adjudication.
The bail system in this country and that whole innocent till proven guilty thing. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's down 16 points today, a tenth of 1%, finished at 18,145, did the blue chips. The NASDAQ ticked up 15 points, about a third percent, 52.57. The S&P 500 flat, 21.41. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow up less than a tenth of 1%, the NASDAQ up 0.8%, the S&P 500 up 0.4%. AT&T down 3% today on that news. It's in talks to buy Time Warner. Time Warner, meanwhile, gained 7.8% on the news. The rest of the telecom sector came under siege. Verizon off nearly 2%. Sprint jogged down 2.5% today. McDonald's up 3% after its earnings beat investors' forecast. Wendy's up 0.8%. Bond prices up. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note down 1.73% is the yield. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl, here with a statistic on the way into this next story. According to the Puerto Rican government, roughly 1,000 Puerto Rican families a month are moving to Florida. The economy on the island is flat lousy, as we have reported. The government is dealing with billions of dollars in unpayable debt. Unemployment's at 12%, and half of all families there are living under the poverty line. Which means cities in Florida, Kissimmee in this instance, have had to react to this population growth in real time with jobs and business opportunities. Marketplace's Andy Euler spent a week in Central Florida to see how that's working out.
This isn't the first massive migration from the island to the mainland. The so-called Great Migration of Puerto Ricans to New York City happened after World War II. In 1950, there were almost 200,000 of them in the city. In 1960, that number had swelled to over 600,000. Carlos Vargas Ramos is a research associate at the Center for Puerto Rican Studies at Hunter College. He says today, New York is too expensive, so Puerto Ricans are moving to Florida. And the impetus is still the same.
The reason why Puerto Ricans are moving to the United States is for the same reason they have been moving to the United States for the past 100 years. Jobs, jobs, jobs.
The big draw in this part of Central Florida is Disney World, where they always need entry-level janitors and housekeepers. And the money's pretty good compared to what you can make on the island. And remember, because Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens, they don't need green cards to work. And those people need a place to live. Some stay with family, others use motels, and some are looking to buy property. David Levis is CEO of a mortgage lending company called Money House. He's also Puerto Rican and decided to open this office in Kissimmee 2 years ago. He now commutes between both places.
Right now, we're actually recruiting mortgage loan officers that are licensed mortgage loan officers that are Puerto Rican and that speak Spanish, and because we do want to cater to each one of our clients.
And Florida locals are spotting the opportunity, too. Daisy Lopez Cid owns a RE/MAX brokerage in downtown Kissimmee. She says she has realtors of many different backgrounds and says she's always looking for more who know specific communities. Right now, the one to know is Puerto Rican.
It is happening. You have a lot of migration coming in from Puerto Rico. So you have a lot of realtors there that are moving here looking for employment and selling to the rest of the ones that they know that are moving here.
There's another place looking to hire Puerto Ricans that might not be as obvious as the housing sector. It's local government. Mike Steigerwald is the Kissimmee city manager. He says they're looking for Puerto Ricans who can relate to the culture and difficulty of getting acclimated. But finding Puerto Ricans to fill those positions can be a struggle.
It's very easy for me to diversify at the lower levels of our workforce. But as we get up into the upper management positions, into the leadership positions, and more technical positions, it's increasingly difficult because the language barrier is much more accentuated at that higher level of position.
He says the city's feeling it in the education system, too. It's not just individuals moving here to get work. It's families, and their kids need bilingual teachers. It's just another job opportunity in this little Central Florida town of just over 60,000. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
were talking yesterday about some of the issues being raised around bail, specifically around cash bail and low-income people accused of minor offenses. At least 10 class action lawsuits have been filed in the past 2 years challenging the practice. The U.S. Department of Justice now argues that fixed cash bail for impoverished people is unconstitutional. There are alternatives out there to using money bail, though, as Marketplace's Bree Benishaw reports in this second of two stories.
In most of the country, if you're arrested for something, there's a chance you'll be asked to pay money bail to get out of jail until your court date. Estimates vary, but tens and possibly hundreds of thousands of people end up staying in jail only because they can't afford bail.
Here in D.C., we do not use money in terms of setting conditions of release.
Cliff Keenan is head of the Washington, D.C. Pretrial Services Agency. He says nobody who's in jail in Washington is there because they can't afford bail.
Income has absolutely nothing to do with it. We have a scientifically validated risk assessment instrument.
When someone is arrested, they're given a score of how likely they are to show up to their court date and how likely they are to get in trouble again if they're released.
A risk score.
It's based on 70 different inputs.
Such as number of prior warrants that may have been issued, prior criminal history, ties to the community, et cetera, et cetera.
So when someone's arrested, that's what helps determine if they're free to go or are kept in jail.
Our computer system actually has the algorithms running in the background. So our data set will go ahead and calculate what that score is, and that score, in fact, will generate the recommendations that we're providing to the judge and the prosecutor and the defense attorney.
Keenan says around 90% of people end up being released, often with some kind of supervision. And he says the computer programs that predict who will show up at court are pretty accurate.
Almost 90% of our persons who are on pretrial release make it back for all of their court appearances. We also find that about 89% remain arrest-free. And of those who are arrested, only about 1% are charged with a violent crime.
But the algorithms are one place where this approach gets criticized.
The risk is that the algorithms often incorporate data that may perpetuate racial biases in the criminal justice system.
Joshua Norkin is a staff attorney with the Legal Aid Society of New York.
For example, we know that black and white people use drugs at roughly the same rate, yet black people are three times roughly more likely to be arrested for the same crime than white people.
To the extent that biased data is fed into an algorithm, it might disadvantage blacks, says Norkin.
I think it's a legitimate concern.
Keeduk Lee is a researcher at the Urban Institute. He helped D.C. develop its pretrial services risk assessment tool. He says algorithms, or actuarial tools, as he calls them, aren't infallible, but they're much better than humans.
We cannot control what other irrelevant factors, such as race, might influence their decision-making the same way we can control it in an actuarial decision-making tools.
Another point of contention in D.C.'s system is that the majority of people who are released from jail have to submit to some kind of supervision. And this could range from just checking in to drug testing to a GPS ankle bracelet.
It extracts punishment before adjudication.
David Feige chairs the Bronx Freedom Fund. It's a charity that posts bail for people in the Bronx who can't afford it.
That is to say, it makes you do all these things that feel like probation on cases where, A, you may not even be guilty, and B, even if you were guilty, you might not be subject to any of these things.
Defenders of D.C. system say people considered to be low risk aren't placed under any supervision outside a reminder to come to court. Supervision is a compromise, they argue, and a judge ultimately makes the decision. Finally, they point out that in D.C., it's at least 10 times cheaper to supervise someone than to incarcerate them. One group that remains opposed to D.C. system is the money bail industry itself.
Bail promotes liberty. And there's accountability, and there's due process.
Jeff Clayton is policy director of the American Bail Coalition, a trade group representing bail bondsmen. He says with money bail, the community at least has a way to contest the decision of a judge to detain someone.
It's those instances where the government needs to be challenged and not lock somebody up and throw away the key.
No state has fully adopted D.C.'s cashless bail system, but there is a growing unease with money bail in many jurisdictions. Kentucky, Colorado, and New Jersey discourage the use of cash bail for low-risk defendants, and many more states are still grappling with the issue ultimately at the bottom of this, what to do about low-income people stuck in jail because they are poor. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishaw for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today. No pure marketplace angle on this one, but I'm going to go with it anyway, because sometimes on a Friday of a long week, you just need a little good news. There is a new election survey out from Colby College in the Boston Globe. Please don't turn off the radio. It is good news, I promise. The survey shows 93% of likely voters, 93%, said that when the campaign is all said and done, they just want both sides to calm down, shake hands, and get on about the nation's business. 17 days, y'all, 17 days. All right, Friday quitting time. We got to hit it. The Dow off 16 points today. That's about a 10th percent. The NASDAQ up 15 points, a third percent. The S&P 500 flat, 2141, in case you're curious. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the vice president. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourselves a great weekend, everybody. We'll see you Monday, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.